Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you are back with us today, because today, we are talking about The Flight Attendant, HBO's thriller mystery comedy that's fun and relentless and infuriating.
Ooh, nicely done. That's perfect.
Yeah.
I have nothing to add to that.
Okay, good. I appreciate that. I'm so glad. Because let me tell you, it was maybe a little bit of a challenge to get my husband to finish the show.
Ooh.
Only because he was so frustrated at poor decisions. I'm seeing now that we're talking about this more, and we're talking about some things that I've watched with my husband.
Right, which we've kind of discussed on
right,
the show.
That they don't always have the same taste in entertainment that we do, which is fine.
Yeah, totally fine. But there is a pattern, I think.
There is a pattern. And if a woman makes bad decisions, he gets really frustrated, because I think, bless my sweet husband's heart, he expects women to be smarter.
Well, that's like a backhanded compliment.
Right. Well, yes. And he understands that there are women who make stupid choices.
Yeah.
But also, he wants women to be smart, because he thinks women are smarter in a lot of ways.
Well, and he's not wrong. But I could see how... I can see how, like, when it comes to entertainment, because women have had to work so hard to become, you know, seen as a man's equal on screen, that when you have a woman making poor decisions, which we do,
right?
Because everybody we're does. People,
mm-hmm.
right? It feels like, no, you don't have margin to have flaws. And that's actually the very thing that proves that it's not equal yet. Because a white man can have flaws and be seen as, oh, that's the totality of their experience. Let's dig into this moment. Whereas a woman has a flaw and it's like, no, we don't have room.
Okay, to be fair, he was similarly frustrated with Don Draper in Mad Men.
Well, but that was of that era where it was,
yes,
like...
Yes, but he still made really horrible decisions and really detrimental decisions.
Okay.
And he didn't like that either.
Okay.
So he's intolerant of the protagonist making spectacularly stupid decisions equally.
I'm happy to hear that.
It frustrates him because he's like, women are smarter than this. Why are they making this woman character dumb?
Well, and I get that. Because I struggle with that too. But I think for me, I struggle with the fact that women seem to always have to be perfect, whereas I feel like the man is given a more authentic portrayal of, we struggle, we make bad decisions, and then we try to recover from them. Mm-hmm. Whereas a woman, if you don't nail it, it's that idea that in general, anybody who is not the primary or the majority or the the cool kids, that they have to work twice as hard for the same outcome.
Okay.
And so women have to be that much smarter and that much better to be seen as equal. Successful or equal. And whereas a man doesn't have to work as hard to be seen as successful or equal. And so that's me. But I am really glad to hear that he is equally frustrated with it.
Yeah.
And that does make sense based on what I know that he enjoys versus what he doesn't.
Uh-huh.
The pattern holds for sure.
Yeah. He just gets, he doesn't like people making poor decisions when they have the opportunity to make wise ones.
That makes sense. Well, it's like my dad. He can't stand like not having a happy ending.
Oh,
like on
yeah.
a movie.
Yeah. I can have a not happy ending, but I can't have it be just the most depressing ending.
Yeah, like I'm not okay with like, okay, Ford versus Ferrari. Spoiler alert. The movie has a very, very natural end and conclusion, but then the movie keeps going. And they had me in their corner right up until that end. Because it was one of those things that was like unnecessary sadness. Like you could have done a title screen.
Yeah.
You could have done something that
they could have made 20 minutes less a movie and
saved everybody like a bunch of tears.
Oh.
Yeah. Like unnecessary.
Okay.
Okay. Spoiler alert. Done.
All right. So who's in this? So I haven't watched much Big Bang Theory.
Hold the phone. What?
It's just one of those that it never was on when it was convenient. And then when I would catch middle episodes, I didn't really know the characters well enough to fully appreciate the jokes and what was going on. So I think I need to start at the beginning and go through it.
It's totally worth it because it is, okay, I am not trying to disparage Friends, but it is the new Friends.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like we can have equally, we can have Friends on in the background on repeat, but we can also have Big Bang.
Oh.
My dad, his favorite thing to do is be on Facebook on like the videos and just one little, like,
yeah, just like
one
a clip.
Scene after another of Big Bang for like hours. He'll just go from scene to scene laughing his face off.
Aww.
It's his favorite thing to do. Yeah, it's really digestible and it has the same kind of ensemble cast. And so there's just this,
this nerdy thing. Twist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's just this nerdy twist.
That's fun.
It's very, very fun.
Okay. Well, and I mentioned Big Bang Theory because Kaylee Cuoco was in Big Bang Theory, and this is her first reoccurring role in a live-action show as Cassie Bowden in The Flight Attendant, the main character. This is her first live-action role since she did Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, since went off. Big Bang.
Right.
Right, right.
Yeah. And that's the thing she's most known for. Though she also did the voice of Harley Quinn in an animated show that was like a big deal.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And then Michelle Heisman. I don't know. MICHIELHUISMAN. I don't care what his name is. He's beautiful and perfectly cast as Alex Sokolov. How is Alex Sokolov easier to pronounce than his actual name?
I don't know. What's his?
I don't. He's Dutch.
Okay.
Yeah. It's actually in my notes
right now. You read my mind. I was about to ask that.
No, it was the person at Marie Claire read your mind.
Oh, okay. All right. Because I wasn't sure where he was from. So Dutch. So that gives, yes. Okay. So that gives me a little bit of insight of how his name should be pronounced, but I'm not going to try it.
Okay. Yeah. It's a little insight. Well, Dutch is like
very difficult.
It's really one of the hardest languages to learn. And that's the reason why everybody who speaks Dutch also speaks English. Because
right?
They literally teach them side by side because Dutch is very difficult to speak and they would not be able to speak to
the rest of the world.
The rest of the world.
It's like not like a romantic language where you can kind of do your thing and get through it, right?
No.
Like this is a whole other thing. So
yeah.
But that makes sense now why his name is so difficult for us to pronounce.
Right. Yeah. Yes. But he was in Orphan Black, Age of Adeline, and what I loved him in most was Game of Thrones.
Oh, wait. Who did he play in Game of Thrones?
He was, I can't remember. The character was cast as a different actor the first time they showed him, and it was a love interest of Daenerys Targaryen, the leader of the paid army.
Yeah.
That she had a dalliance with.
Right.
So,
we're going on a tangent. Catch it in the bonus episode. All right,
okay.
We're traversing back to the flight attendant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
So shall I recap the flight attendant?
You should definitely recap the flight attendant.
Okay. Episode one called In Case of Emergency. We follow a lovely blonde flight attendant on her extravagant, exciting adventures with her passport stamped all over the world. She's on an airplane and she's in clubs and there's beautiful people and lots of alcohol. We quickly learn she is a complete mess. Her coworkers know. Her brother knows.
We know.
We all know. So Cassie is great at her job and also horrible at it. And we see both ways how those interplay with one another. So despite a rule that she isn't supposed to date her passengers, Cassie has a beautiful drunken night with the passenger from 3C. And she wakes in a lavish hotel suite only to find Alex 3C Sokolov murdered in the bed next to her. She's a blackout drunk who remembers almost nothing of the night before And there are hallucinations, flashbacks, paranoia, attempting to flee from the FBI. Cassie's in way, way over her head.
Definitely.
That's it.
And that's it.
That's all I'm going to say about that.
Awesome.
We're going to talk. We'll talk about other stuff.
Yeah. But, all right. Yeah. Good. 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 So, but that is the summary.
I mean, real. That's as much as you really
hot
need to
mess
know.
And on the run.
Like. Yeah. Yeah. Gorgeous hot mess.
Yep.
Maybe some mental things going on.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you. I have to tell you that Kaylee's comedic timing.
Oh, genius.
Is on point in this show. She really does a good job. I'm impressed. I mean, it's not like I didn't think she had good comedic timing because Big Bang was amazing. But to see her carry it into a completely different character and different cadence of a show and all of that and just be so on point, like, she's rocking it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's based on a book of the same name, The Flight Attendant, by Chris Bohalian. Kaylee Cuoco's production company optioned the book. Like right after it came out. And it seems like it's pretty much mostly the same, that they follow it pretty closely. But when they leave Bangkok, they go to Paris, not Seoul. So that's a little bit different. Paris isn't on the agenda for the airlines in the show, but it is in the book.
Well, Bangkok to Paris would be a very long flight.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to Seoul, not so much.
Right. Not so much. And I guess in the book, she struggles a bit more about whether she killed him. She questions it a little in the show, but she's pretty sure, because she's not a violent drunk.
Right.
That she didn't kill him. And it seems like she has a little bit more of a struggle with that in the book.
In the book. Well, because visually speaking, when you see the scene, she doesn't have blood on her. She's mm-hmm. not. So if you woke up that way, you wouldn't necessarily think, oh my gosh, what if I
right.
done?
She woke up and she was like out of bed and realizes she's blind drub. She realizes that she has dried blood on her arm, and she goes to ask him what happened, and then realizes.
Yeah, but it's kind of minimal on her, so I can I can see that, like, in her character, that in the show anyways, it didn't lend itself to a whole lot of questioning.
Right.
Like, right in the beginning, we kind of have this as the viewer, whether we're right or wrong, we have kind of a view that this was not her fault.
Right.
But others are going to think it is.
Right.
And that's like the premise for us as the viewers.
Yeah, this is not a spoiler. This is episode one.
Like, yeah, this is right off. Like, right off. Yeah. This is not a spoiler. And we don't know. The show, it continues. We don't completely know.
Right.
Right. But but we don't feel that suspicion right off.
You're kind of rooting for her. She's our heroine, our protagonist in the show. So
yes.
We're rooting for her. We don't want her to be the bad guy.
No.
And I don't think that they want us to believe that she is a murderer.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Generally, it was pretty well reviewed. Vulture called it the Flight Attendant is a goofy, sad escapist caper for our times.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. It's odd to call a thriller a romp, but that's where The Flight Attendant lands, and I certainly did not mind, said Catherine Van Ardonk, which I'm like, that's fair.
That is really fair.
It's a romp. It's fun. It's a thriller, but it's also, like, funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about for comedic timing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think most shows that have this kind of setting and this kind of plot line really fall in that comedic feel, But that's where I'm so impressed with Kaylee Cuoco, because I feel like she brings that.
Right.
It's great.
Yes. Well, they force her to keep the energy of the show going, Kaylee Cuoco, to maintain its light comedy feel, but also register Casey's legitimate fear about losing her grip on what's real and what's not. It's impressive how well it works.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yes, that's well said.
Agreed.
I believe so. And NPR also liked it.
Oh, good.
The Flight Attendant is a fizzy, dark, and funny mystery. And they said it's a long night story.
Oh.
Linda Holmes says, our central character goes out and does something foolish, or perhaps just stumbles onto the wrong place at the wrong time, and suddenly everything is a mess. Like, they have a long night that is affecting the rest of the story. That's yeah. the catalyst, which I'm like, ooh. And then her long night becomes a general rough time. I'm like, oh, that's fair. And
it is fair.
They likened it to Catch Me If You Can a little bit.
I felt the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. With the, I mean, with the flights and the, it's kind of funny, but it's also a little
sad.
Tough. Yeah. A little tough to deal with. You empathize with people who are yeah. making bad choices, but still, they're kind of likable. They dropped it in a really weird schedule. They talk about this in the NPR article. So it dropped on Thanksgiving with 3 episodes. And then the next week, there were 2 more episodes. And the week after that, there were 2 more episodes. And then there was the finale.
Interesting.
So it was kind of a weird schedule.
I wonder why they did that.
They didn't do the week over week, but they didn't do a binge either. And they said they kind of wished that they had.
I think that's worth a shot, a though. What if it had worked really well? Like, yeah. What if, you know.
Exactly.
And I think that's the stuff we're trying to play around with as we move into a different era of media consumption. Mm-hmm. Because we really are there. We've been moving there for a little while.
Right.
But we're trying to bring back some of the, you know, baby out of the bathwater from live television. And I don't mean live television. Like, I mean live premiere
right.
television. I don't know how to say that anymore.
Must-see TV right. was what we called it in the 90s yeah. when Thursday night was must-see TV because you needed to sit down and watch it at 7 o'clock starting with friends.
Right, exactly. And so, like, that was live TV, what we thought about. But we also know that there's a difference between that and, like, live broadcast.
Right.
And now it's all getting kind of... So we're trying to bring back, oh, the fun of, hey, everybody's kind of doing this thing at the same time. And it's very, like, communal. Mm-hmm. And so we're experiencing it. But also try to give people autonomy to binge and
uh-huh.
do, you know, all the different things. And
right. Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
Yes, it is. But I think Entertainment Weekly is maybe a little bit afraid to like things right now.
Oh, yeah. They have not liked have much been, at all.
No, not really. They gave it a B-. Kristen Baldwin said the headline of her article, HBO Max thriller, The Flight Attendant Can't Get Off the Ground. So Kristen Baldwin found that it was a little convenient that Cassie's best friend was a lawyer. And that Cassie's boyfriend was a computer hacker. She just felt like it was all a little too convenient. Which I'm like, no, that's stories. That's...
I mean...
Like, okay. Yeah. You know what? It's convenient that you were a student in psychology and that made sense to work on this show together.
Yeah, right? I mean,
it's convenient. It's convenient that I know graphic designers and filmmakers and, you know, different kinds of people who do different kinds of jobs who can help me out with stuff.
Right.
It's convenient. No, it's my life. Yeah. Sometimes you just know people who can help you with stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's that odd that a person might have in their group of closest best friends a lawyer.
Right.
But I don't think the show tries to make it seem like this is the only friend,
no.
the only best friend.
Right.
This is the friend who is a good friend for a long time, but mm-hmm. also is the one who she would call, obviously, in this situation.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And if the situation had been different, maybe she has a different friend that she could also call right. and yeah. have.
Maybe the host of a true crime show who would know about weird laws in other countries.
Right? Well, I mean, yeah. Yeah.
She wasn't an expert in Bangkok law.
I mean, thank you, right?
I mean, so I just think maybe Entertainment Weekly is a little too afraid to be too glowing of things.
Yeah, I don't know.
At the moment. And it was originally supposed to be a limited series, but it has been picked up for season 2.
Hey.
Yep. So, you know, that's...
That's great.
It's great. I'm excited and curious to see how it's going to change and grow and be something different. I hope it's good.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too, because it's definitely an enjoyable thing to go and dive into.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy.
It is.
It's a little easy.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to... If you don't understand what's going on, that's kind of okay.
It's kind of okay.
They'll explain it to you later.
Yeah. Some people might really hate the exposition,
mm-hmm.
you know, but on the other hand, sometimes you just need entertainment that's a little less work.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And this is one of those shows, and that's delightful.
Yeah, exactly. All right, when we come back, is it true, psychology break, and real life?
Hey, this is Kate. I'm a forensic psychologist and crisis clinician, and I collect stories. Everything from true crime to trauma to parenthood. There's a lot more in common between depression and sociopathy, or between serial killers and podcasters, than you might think. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss at iwbpodcast.com and iwbpodcast on social media.
So here's how it works. Christy wrecks her search history. Hey, NSA, we promise it's nothing more nefarious than a podcast. To find out what's true, some of the psychological motivations behind the character's actions, and real-life applications that relate to our topic. I have no idea what Christy decided to look up. Could be the same thing that captured my curiosity or something I never thought of.
So the Washington Post did a little bit of my job for me.
Oh, really?
Fact-checking HBO Max's The Flight Attendant with real flight attendants.
Hey, Washington Post.
I was like, oh, that's so awesome. I mean, there are plenty of other things that I looked up because this by no means covered the extent of my curiosity.
I can't, no, I would think that to be true.
But it was a good start.
I'm sure. All right, so hit me up. What we got.
So, being a flight attendant can indeed be glamorous at times. You get a 24-hour layover. You get to go to Paris and do all the things. And it's so very glamorous, says Brianna Burnett from Atlanta.
Well, of course. Yes. If you're stationed out in Atlanta,
there's lots of cool places to go. Yeah. Yep. The partying part is a phase, usually.
I can imagine.
Yeah, like it's really difficult, even with a 24-hour layover, to go and party that hard and then be able to do your job. And so Burnett said that it's a phase and it's not realistic to the extent that Cassie does it. Flight attendants cannot drink on the job.
Yes, they cannot.
They get drug tested randomly, according to Heather Holding, who's based out of Chicago. She said they get tested regularly for drugs and alcohol and like after a flight. So if they were drinking on a flight, they would be caught right away and dismissed. So, yeah, maybe not.
Yeah. And so your flight attendants are not drunk.
Right. Flight attendants do not hook up with passengers on flights.
Really? Okay, because this was one of my questions.
Uh-huh.
I was hoping you were going to go there because I feel like there's nobody who's going to admit this is true.
Well, that they do probably not. Now, the lavatories generally aren't places you're going to want to spend a lot of time.
Oh, gosh. No, that whole like myth. I'm like, that's disgusting. Yeah. But it's not a myth. And that's even more disgusting.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you have thoughts about that.
Well, I'll get there.
Okay. All right.
I'll get to some. I'm not going to get to that myth. We're going to talk about the lavatories a little more.
Oh, okay.
In a little bit.
All right.
It's not that new. But now, Cassie's airline had a rule against passengers and flight attendants meeting up, dating later, they met on the job, and that's not really a thing. That's not
okay.
That's
this is
not breaking a rule. That wouldn't be breaking a rule, but hooking up on the flight, not a thing.
Oh well, of course not. Okay, I'm there. That's what I thought.
So Cassie hooked up on the flight and then went out,
and I thought that's totally uncool.
Okay, right.
That's not okay.
Yeah, no, don't hook up at work.
But I figured that the reality was that they didn't usually have a rule against a passenger and a flight attendant.
A passenger and a flight attendant going on a date afterwards, totally fine. Doing it in the lav, not so much.
Yeah, well, because nobody's allowed to just do it when you're on the job.
No, not generally.
Not generally.
There might be a few jobs where that's acceptable.
Maybe so.
They're not jobs we're going to talk about.
No.
No.
But like in general, this is frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They also talked about how Cassie's small bag that she has with her is really unrealistic. Yeah, they don't pack. She had a beautiful beaded gown in this tiny little bag. No, that's not how that would work.
Yeah, I figured that. I mean, okay, so you know that I have flown a lot.
Yeah.
Right? But I figured, you know, she had the little bag, but usually that tiny little bag is only for certain small, you know, hops, you know, but like usually you see the flight attendants, they do have small bags, but they usually have the one, you know, carry on size and then the other one that's the underseater on top.
Right.
Yes. Usually.
Yes. Because you know what? They pack like I do, which is when we go on an airplane, we pack the things that we need immediately. Mm-hmm. So depending on where you're going, that might change what it is. You always need pajamas. You always need at least clean underwear, maybe a full change of clothes, depending on how much you need to take in your bag. Any medicines you need, maybe a bathing suit, depending on where you're going. So if your bag gets lost, you're not completely without.
No, wait. Are we saying that flight attendants tend to also check other luggage?
I would think so, yeah.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think so.
Oh, I think if they're going to stay over 24 hours, they'll probably check it back.
Really? Okay. Okay. That makes sense. It's not something I thought about before.
Yeah.
I guess I always assumed because I'm a very light packer.
Yeah. Yes, you are.
I went to New York City for 10 days and I took a weekender bag on my shoulder. And I did actually have a gown because I was singing at Carnegie Hall. So I had like a gown and like shoes and like the whole thing all in this like 31 weekender bag. Yeah. I'm a light packer.
Yeah. See, and I'm an overpacker because I have to be prepared for all contingencies because anxiety. Yeah. So it is true that being a flight attendant can be pretty lonely. It's a tough job. Everything is extremely last minute if you're going to do it with family or friends because you never quite know exactly what your schedule is going to be like. You don't want to commit to things that you need tickets for and different things because if your flight's delayed, you might miss it. I mean, just because you're supposed to be back in time doesn't mean you're actually going to get back in time because there's weather and equipment failure and all those different things. So, and it can take a toll on close relationships. So it is challenging. And flight attendants do tend to be friends with their coworkers.
I can imagine.
Yeah. It's a little less poddish and cliquish than it was showed on the show. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't work with exactly the same crew quite as much as Cassie does. Mm-hmm. But they do tend to be friendly and they'll go out to dinner together if they're in a overnight somewhere.
That makes sense. Yep. I'm not surprised by that.
Yep. So Cassie's lawyer friend, Annie, who is played by Zoysia Mamet, who was known from Girls, is her biggest thing that she was in. And Tales of the City. She was great in that too. Says the laws in Thailand are very strict. She is not wrong. Nomads.com has 12 laws in Thailand. How to stay out of jail. I'm going to talk about all of them. But basically, they say the drug laws are very, very strict. And any kind of possession can land you in a whole lot of hot water. Mm-hmm. So be careful. Disrespecting the royal family is extremely severe. Any serious offense to defame, insult, or threaten the royal family or any image of the royal family is an issue. So do not write on the money. Oh. If you see money on the ground, don't step on it because that's defaming the royal family in their eyes under their rules.
Okay.
So just, you know, you would want to be really careful about that. And Thai law requires that travelers from outside of the country carry ID at all times. Mm-hmm. So if you were going to rent a scooter or a motorcycle or a jet ski, you wouldn't want to leave your passport as collateral.
Okay.
It's better to leave a large money deposit than not have your ID on you because that can be a serious consequence. they have a law that you always have to wear underwear when you're in public, but I guess that one's not easily enforced or not readily enforced because you would have to like flash your booty at somebody for them to know for sure.
Yeah.
So that one's not a big deal, but you do have to wear a shirt while you're driving a car.
Oh.
Shirtless driving is strictly prohibited.
Okay. Strictly.
Strictly prohibited.
Why? Well, never mind. Yeah. That is a rabbit trail.
That's a whole thing. Wow. That I don't know that much about.
All right. So it is strict. So she was right to be concerned.
Yes.
She was not going to find sympathetic people who assumed innocence.
No. No, no. So there's a hallucination where Alex reminds Cassie that she read an article about somebody who got 5 years in prison for littering on a sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked for an article specifically about that, and I couldn't find one.
Interesting.
But I did find an article in the Chicago Tribune about some people who went to a national park in Thailand, and they left litter at their camping site and abandoned their tent. And they kind of made an example out of these people in that they packed up all their stuff. They figured out who was staying at that campsite, packed up all their stuff, and mailed it to them with a note that said, "You have forgotten some of your belongings at the Khao Yai National Park."
Wow. But you know what? Who does that?
That's really like,
hello,
poor camping etiquette.
That's very, very bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I'm kind of proud of them for that. I'm on their side.
I'm on their side too. And they're stupid criminals because they left a prescription bottle in the tent. But littering in the national park, had they decided not to make an example of them, if they just decided to fine them, could result in 5 years in prison.
Ooh.
Or a fine of up to $16,000.
Oh, wow. So she wasn't wrong about
this. She
wasn't
wrong about the 5 years, but it wasn't just littering on the sidewalk. It was a fairly large mess in a national park.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not okay with maybe 5 years in jail for that. That's a little steep.
That's a little
but
steep.
I'm okay with them publicly shaming these
definitely.
People.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Imperial Atlantic is, of course, fictional.
Right.
Yeah. Cassie was right. Women don't have it great in Crime and Punishment.
No.
Fyodor Dostoevsky has his main character decide he's going to kill a woman to rob her. And it's this whole thing. He thinks it's going to make his life better. And it does not. And even the female protagonist, not great.
No.
But a little one-dimensional doesn't work out so great for...
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's right.
Yeah, she's right. She's right to find that troubling.
Yes.
Doesn't stop her from going out with Alex, though.
No.
Because he's beautiful.
Let's
be honest. If he had been a little bit less cute and a big fan of Crime and Punishment, she might not have gone out with him.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Mm-hmm. Are lavatories really that big on international flights?
Okay, they are pretty big.
Yeah.
I mean,
you've been on international flights. Yes.
And my favorite ones are the ones in the center of the airplane because, all right. So on the larger aircrafts, right. And in the center lavatories, they usually have a nice sized fold down changing table. And when you are traveling with infant and toddler in tow and you've got to take both of them because you can't leave the toddler in the chair to go change the infant, you know, diaper because you're traveling alone. To go into there and be able to fit my toddler, fold down a changing table, you know, it was tall enough that I could set the toddler on the toilet and the thing was folded over him and then the baby's on the thing. And yet still when I could put that up and there was still room for me to do my business.
Oh.
Like, I have to tell you, that's a lot of moving around and shuffling and all of that. And we were able to get it done. I got hands washed and... We all made it out of there. So some of them are pretty nice, but it is not large for certain activities.
Yeah. Right. Yes. 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 And the nicer the airline, the more likely you are to have a larger restroom. Evidently, the Emirates airline has showers on board even.
Oh, some of the new ones. And I just, like, it's not going to happen anytime soon, but I'm dying to go on, like, the Dreamliner and see some of those because it's like, ooh, how fun, like, how neat. I don't know. It's just so interesting.
It is interesting. So Unisphere is a real company.
Okay, yes.
But it's not a asset management company.
No, okay. What is it?
It's a German company that, let's see, from their website, unisphere.de, we advance unmanned aviation with smart flight management solutions adapted to your individual needs.
So drones.
Yes.
Okay.
Basically. Yes. Cool. Unmanned flight, which I thought was pretty cool. And Cassie must be really well paid.
She looks to be, but she only has herself. So
she only has herself. But the reason that I say she must be really well paid is because she was using her phone all over Bangkok. She's making lots of phone calls. So
I'm gonna make a prediction here.
Okay.
I'm gonna predict that you found that it's not that expensive. What did you find?
No, that's why I said she really needs to be well paid. Because on Trippy, somebody asked a question. They were going to Bangkok and they thought it would be handy to have their iPhone. Mm-hmm. They're like, I've never been. I need to be able to call people. I need to look at maps and look things up and be able to do this. And so Debbie from San Francisco answered, technically, you could use your AT&T plan with your iPhone in Thailand, but if you use your iPhone every day for calls and data with your current plan, be prepared to come home to a $2,000 plus phone bill, no exaggeration. Even if you've made prior arrangements with AT&T to use your phone for a discounted rate overseas, the cost for phone calls and data is very, very expensive.
Okay, so that is confusing though, because the add-on plans for these countries are usually not that much.
Yeah.
It cost me $10 extra a month when my husband was deployed to be able to call, text, and everything in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe because you were calling there?
No.
Was he calling back too?
Uh-huh.
Oh. Maybe.
Well, he had a burner phone. It cost him like $10 a month.
Right.
Really, like $10 a month either way. And he had just bought a burner phone kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah, but he was using a phone on their network that he bought there, right?
He was, but I wasn't.
Yes, and yes. And that's the difference, is because if you had been in Afghanistan using your phone to call somewhere else, that probably would have been an issue. That's the point, is you're using your phone plan based in the U.S. to call mm-hmm. to make calls from outside of the U.S. That was the issue. It was this whole thing that they're talking about
totally
in this article.
That. I don't know. I'm skeptical on this one because I feel like maybe she didn't do it right.
Well, here's what she said. She called and made plans and asked about it. And they basically said it's going to be prohibitively expensive. So she unlocked her iPhone and bought a Thai SIM card to use while she was there. It had unlimited talk and data for $50.
That's an easy way to do that.
But even if you just call and talk to them, they might tell you, you're better off with a burner. You're better off.
Or just buy a different
SIM card. You have to unlock your card, or unlock your phone to be able to use that card. But if you own your phone, if you're not on a upgrade plan or whatever, as long as you've paid for it. Even if you haven't paid for it, if you're not paying through AT&T, you can have your phone unlocked.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I just know that a lot of the plans have per country travel add-ons. Mm-hmm. So that for a certain month, you add a plan, and then when you travel to that country, you just use it on there for whatever that extra cost was.
Right.
Maybe just AT&T sucks.
That's possible. That's also possible.
Yeah. And by the way, they do have a cruise add-on for anyone who's necessary.
Oh. Huh?
When you go on a cruise, you just add it on for that month that you're going on the cruise, and it'll work anywhere. Oh.
That's so nice for people who like cruises. I'm so happy for you. I'm so happy that's an easy thing for you to add. I'm never going on a cruise.
I know you're not. My family can't wait to go on a cruise. I know. And I say my family because I'm still a little like, we're not far enough removed from the pandemic for me to even be thinking about a cruise. But they like can't wait.
Yeah. Oh, well, good. Yeah. I'm so happy for you. Okay. Jackie and I agree on a lot of things. Cruises are not one of them.
That's funny.
All right, psychology break.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right. So Recovery Ways, which is a treatment center, had an article about flight attendants and that because they constantly trade sleep for their livelihood and there's a lot of stress in their job, that they have read studies that said that flight attendants who have substance abuse are most likely to abuse alcohol. So that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Maybe painkillers because their job is pretty physical, or anti-anxiety medication or amphetamines to stay awake, but mostly it's alcohol to relax.
Right.
Yeah.
After the stress.
Right.
Well, because you have to be so on it.
Right.
All the time. Like, people don't realize they're not just waitresses in the sky.
No, they're first responders.
They're first responders. And people don't know this. I'm really...
Which is really annoying.
It's really sad because they really are first responders. Uh-huh. They are flat out. And they're even more trained in some ways than your typical first responder because they understand so much about all the different scenarios that could be, you know.
Right.
That could develop.
Then I read a synopsis of a journal article. I wasn't going to pay to read the whole journal article because the abstract had everything that I needed. Mental health and substance abuse characteristics of flight attendants versus other clients in residential treatment.
Okay.
They're researchers, not headline writers.
Oh, yes. No, these are titles. These are not headlines.
Yes.
Yes.
So they had some limited research where they looked at flight attendants who were admitted to residential substance abuse. And then they looked at their charts. Mm-hmm. And then they looked at the charts of randomly selected other clients in treatment at the same time.
Okay.
So that they could kind of compare. And of course, this is pretty limited. But here's what they found. They said it was not statistically significant between group differences were found in suicide rates or quality of life. But the flight attendants actually reported fewer symptoms related to their substance abuse. And they tended to be happier with their lives as opposed to other people who in the substance abuse. But the conclusion, although flight attendants were shown to be somewhat higher functioning than their treatment peers, mental health professions need to be aware of the need to address flight attendants' lack of insight into their substance-related problems. They were less likely to see their abuse as an issue, which I'm like, that's Cassie. She understands that she has a substance abuse problem, but she doesn't think it's a problem until it's a big problem.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Small sample. Statistically.
Yeah.
They're less likely because they're high functioning.
Or they're less likely to report it, even if they know better, which is the problem you get with self-report, is you're not really quite sure whether it's a real lack of insight or it's a lack of telling you.
Right.
Because as you're reading that, this is what I'm picturing. Bye-bye. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. See you next time. Bye-bye. It's that constant happy face to de-escalate fear.
Yeah.
And I don't know that you can just turn that off.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that as a flight attendant that you can be on flights where there may be something of concern. And because you're in the air, everything's serious. And you are putting on this happy face no matter what. I mean, if you've ever heard flight attendants have to give severe instructions, there's still like this weird cadence and kindness to them that's authoritative and yet
trying to calm you down.
Calm you down.
Those are the ones that scare me the most because when they start sounding like that, I know they're freaking terrified.
Yes. But they can. So if you're going to ask them about their problem, I can imagine that it'd be hard to turn that off.
Right.
Don't know that it's severe, right? But they're trying to de-escalate it in a way. I don't know. That would be like my next research question. Like, what's causing that? You know, like, is it the training? Is it an actual lack of awareness? And is that predictive of whether they'll choose to be flight attendants or what? I don't know.
Yes, it's the chicken or the egg.
Yes. Chicken or the egg. Like, who knows? Ooh. Right?
All right. So Cassie has some pretty severe hallucinations
that are delightful to watch.
They're hilarious and so insightful and so endearing. This is why you love Alex.
Yes.
Even though we don't really know Alex, really, we should love Cassie more because Alex is a figment of her imagination.
Yeah, it's really her talking to herself.
But he's so pretty.
Yes, yes, he is.
So that's actually not really all that unusual to have hallucinations during grief, which I think is absolutely what's going on. She's like afraid.
Yeah.
But she's also got some grief.
Yeah. Well, that first episode particularly, and I've watched more than one episode.
Yeah.
But it does show her and him having quite a connection.
Yes.
And so there's a devastation here. It's not just a one-night stand that ended up dead in her bed.
No, he took time to get to know her and ask her insightful questions about her life and her job and was she lonely. And
right. Like when she wakes up in the morning, the look on her face says, stability. I have found stability. Like she really plays that well of that, I can relax. Uh-huh. I found something just really nice.
This is really special, and even if it's not long term, it's going to be a special memory forever. What I can remember,
right? But then it turns into definitely something she'll remember,
right,
forever, and horrific,
right? So, World Psychiatry had a journal article basically about this, and that they were saying that normal grief is, there's no simple answer as to what that is. Right. It's not a complicated grief because that tends to be longer term.
And create particularly severe diagnoses.
Right.
Like,
yes.
It's not just like they're complicated grief in the psychology world is an actual diagnosis itself.
Right.
But it indicates that grief has now sort of transformed
into a pathology,
like of depression and anxiety and such. And
right.
And I say transformed, but I really mean it kind of
it's
added layered to the basket of things that you're dealing with. You know, it's not like the grief goes away and becomes, it's just all of a sudden you have all of these other things that you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Whereas there is a certain level of depression and anxiety in typical grief.
Mm-hmm. So they talk about how acute grief is what occurs in the early aftermath, which is probably what Cassie is dealing with, because this is immediately after a very, very intense event that involves grief. It can be intensely painful, characterized by behaviors and emotions that would be considered unusual in normal everyday life. These include sadness and crying, other unfamiliar dysphoric emotions.
Nicely put.
I thought so. And they talk about how grief is not merely separation from the person who died, but finding new and meaningful ways of continuing their relationship with the deceased, and that it's not unusual for bereaved individuals to dream of deceased loved ones, to look for them in crowds, to feel their presence, to feel them watching out for them and protecting them, for them to rehearse or speak out loud different conversations that they'd have or would like to have with the deceased. And auditory or visual hallucinations of the deceased person are often seen in acute grief.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought totally made sense. And then Scientific American had an article, Ghost Stories, Visits from the Deceased. After a loved one dies, most people see ghosts.
Now that's a headline.
That's a headline. Exactly. This is not a journal article. This is an article with a headline. Yep. Von Bell. Now this is a fairly old article. It's from 2008. But I think that people are still probably, you know, going to have similar reactions. Yeah. That's not really.
When you said this is an old article, I didn't think you were going to say 2008.
You thought like way older than
way
that.
Way older.
Yeah, but that's like 13 years ago.
I know.
That's like a whole child ago.
I know.
For weird. Both of us.
Weird.
They said grief hallucinations are a normal reaction to bereavement, but are rarely discussed because people fear they might be considered insane or mentally destabilized by their loss. Hallucinations are common in sober, healthy people and are more likely in times of stress.
Yes.
I had no idea that how common that was.
I feel like we talk about it in the art a lot.
Uh-huh.
And we absorb it from movies and books and things as something of a tangible representation of those inner monologues we might have.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that actually what we're trying to say is this is actually normal.
Right.
This is actually what people are experiencing, like this real.
So they're barely studied, even though it's a really normal reaction to loss, mm-hmm. to have these hallucinations that are pretty vivid. People are like, they have whole conversations. They see the person, the whole thing. But most people tend to find these experiences comforting rather than upsetting.
Yeah, that makes
so
sense to me.
That's less troubling.
Yeah, I feel like that makes sense to me. I'm not mm-hmm. surprised by that one.
All right. Real life?
Real life.
I loved the way the cinematography was handled in this.
Yeah.
They really advanced the story by putting two different images on the screen at one time next to one another.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was really effective. It was a way to move the story forward in a really effective way, but really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you could kind of, you get either a sense of what's happening, travel usually, or who somebody is, her drinking in nightclubs and going home with men, whatever. You get this information really quickly and kind of beautifully.
Yeah.
And it was really well done. Well, that's called the multi-dynamic image technique.
Okay, I have to ask, does this article mention anything about 24?
No. It's Wikipedia. And because it was the very first instance that was kind of a forerunner of this technique was from 1956,
mm-hmm.
and it was in the 60s when they started doing it. So
okay.
They didn't, if they mentioned 24, it's not on the page I printed out.
Oh, okay. Well, because the reason I ask is because I feel like 24 is like an icon of this technique.
Okay.
To me.
Yeah.
And maybe people feel like other things are a better icon, but the way that 24 did it, just to me, was like an icon because, you know, they operated and they had 24 episodes.
Right.
Each episode was an hour.
Right.
And so
it was real time.
Each show was real time. And so they had to use this technique to advance the separate storylines and how they intersected throughout the whole series. And
that's
it was
pretty
like,
cool.
I love it.
It's a really cool technique.
I love it.
It really,
I think it's cool.
Really effective. Okay. I didn't know Bangkok had canals.
I don't think I quite realize this either.
It's called the Venice of the East.
Oh.
Like, it's this whole thing that it used to be like how they got around Bangkok. So when
really?
They, when
like
they,
that much? That salient?
That salient? Like, it used to be in that part of the world when they built a city, they would build a moat around it.
Okay.
And that's how it started. And as the city grew beyond what was inside the moat,
mm-hmm.
these canals became more prominent and they would connect them. And that was how people traveled around the city.
Hmm.
And then as colonization happened, as it does, the people from outside wanted roads. They could bring their horses and buggies and things
right.
in. And so they filled in some of the canals and it's mostly roadway now, but it's still really used for like commuting.
Interesting.
Like they have like boats like that run like buses on the canals.
My goodness.
Yeah. So
that's kind of cool.
I think it's kind of cool. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think Amanda Knox was a bad comparison.
Okay. I don't think so either. I think it was a great comparison actually.
Well, because briefly biography says Amanda Knox was an American college student who was convicted and then acquitted of the murder of her British roommate Meredith Kircher in Italy. Knox's acquittal was overturned in 2013, and she was again convicted of murder in 2014, and her conviction was overturned again in 2015.
Yeah.
It's a back, snip, snap, back and forth.
It was awful. It was awful.
It was a really awful thing because she didn't have enough visible grief, which is the thing we have talked about before, that just because somebody doesn't have the kind of reaction that you think they ought to doesn't mean that they're necessarily guilty of anything.
Right.
Yeah. Just because she wasn't showing enough grief in the way they thought she ought to be showing it, it seemed like she needed to be convicted that she must be the murderer.
Yeah. And the way that the Italian, you know, law enforcement sort of approached it didn't help.
No.
Not that I disparage them. I don't want to disparage them. I know they have their own cultures, but being somebody who is an American in the culture made for a very difficult time.
Right.
With parsing all of that out. And, you
right.
know, and that's why I think a lot of people said that, like, Cassie made these terrible decisions, and I'm kind of like, actually, I kind of feel her pain there.
Yeah.
Like, I feel the reasons. I get it. The reasons.
I get it too. I get it because she probably wasn't going to get a fair shake.
No.
And that's why this is such a salient example to use.
Yeah, exactly.
That it was a different culture, and it was that they were going to go for the easy way out. You could kind of feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And Cassie was the easy way out.
Oh, yeah.
I think Amanda Knox may have been kind of the easy way out. And it's baffling to me that she could be acquitted and have that overturned.
Oh, I know. That's like terrifying.
I mean, that's not a thing that we do in the U.S.
No. Nope.
And so, it's such an interesting story. And I'm sorry she had to live it, but it makes for fascinating television watching and reading.
It does.
So there's a whole lot I didn't know about air marshals.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that.
Yes, because Cassie is creeped out by a bald guy, and it turns out he's an air marshal. He's the new air marshal. We talked about this. So less than 1% of flights within the U.S. have an air marshal, and it's run by a federal air marshal's service. Mm-hmm. But most flights keep at least a seat or two open for the air marshal.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yes. And they use a risk assessment software to determine what flights they ought to be on.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks at the aircraft, departure city, flight path, destinations, and the amount of fuel on board,
mm-hmm.
which is a thing we have to look at after September 11th.
Yes.
Yes. What do air marshals actually do? This is, from gotravelyourway.com, by the way. They detect behavior that indicates a possible threat. So it might be somebody drunk, violent, somebody who is acting strange or cagey. Mm-hmm. They might just keep a closer eye on that person, and they're trained to deal with it. If you want to be an air marshal, there are some fairly restrictive.
I can imagine.
Yeah. You need to have a bachelor's degree. They suggest a degree in criminal justice.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be between 21 and 37 years old.
That's kind of across the board for federal service, agents.
Yeah. Yeah. But I get the impression that once you're over 37, you're going to be directing things. You're not going to be on the flights.
Maybe so.
Yeah. And they have to have lots of assessments, physical assessments, psychological assessments, all different kinds of things. The flight crew does indeed know who the air marshal is. Any armed passenger, air marshal, law enforcement, any of that, they're going to be introduced to the cockpit and cabin crew. They're going to look at their IDs. All of those people are going to know where that person is sitting, where the air marshal is sitting, mm-hmm. or the law enforcement, anybody with a gun theoretically, you shouldn't be able to make it on the plane with a gun unless you're
an air marshal
or a police officer, or for some reason, other mm-hmm. reason, they would know about you and they're going to know where you're seated. You can't really spot an air marshal, but if you're looking for one, they would be unaccompanied. They're going to board at the very last minute. They're going to have an aisle seat near the back of the plane, which I didn't realize that they would have a specific place. And they will never sleep on the flight, even if it's long. They're going to be awake the entire time.
Yeah, well, because they're working.
Right. Well, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, but flight attendants are working, but they, on long haul flights like that, they have bunks where they can go and rest.
They can take shifts.
Right.
And I guess an air marshal, unless there's two, they right. can't do a shift.
Right.
Yeah.
Not all countries have an air marshal program. The countries that do are Australia, Austria, Canada, India, Ireland, Pakistan, Singapore, the UK, and the US. And the only airline that has air marshals or sky marshals on every flight is LL Airlines out of Israel.
Well,
they have one
yeah.
on every flight.
Of course. That's a whole thing.
That's a whole thing.
And that doesn't surprise me at all.
No, me either. Cassie said she's not a violent drunk. So the Springboard Center, which is an addiction treatment facility, okay. has four categories of drunks.
Oh, interesting. Ooh. Okay.
So, and they have them cutely named.
Oh, goodness.
The Hemingways, which are peoples whose personalities don't change much. And this actually makes up the plurality of drinkers. About 40% of drinkers don't have their personalities significantly changed.
Okay.
Even when they overindulge.
Okay.
Yeah. Then there's the Mary Poppins, people who are very cheerful or helpful. They become more friendly and outgoing, and they tend to experience few alcohol-related problems.
Okay.
Because they're not picking fights.
Right. Well, that's true.
Because they're Mary Poppins. The nutty professors, these are the people who are uninhibited when they drink. They show the largest personality trait overall. And I would suggest that Cassie is a nutty professor.
Okay.
She's very uninhibited when she drinks and very nervous when she doesn't.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes sense.
And then there's the Mr. Hydes, which Cassie is sure she is not, because they are the mean, violent drunks.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're, according to this, Mr. Hyde type drinkers should quit drinking as soon as possible. Which I thought was really funny. Yeah.
Fair.
Uh-huh. So maybe Cassie should have waited for that union rep when she was talking to the FBI. So she should not have tried to flee the airport.
No,
when they called
for
her.
That was not a good decision.
The FBI wanted to talk to her, and she knew that, and she tried to leave the airport and tried to blame it on autopilot. Not a good idea. But H. Michael Steinberg, who's an attorney, on his blog, wrote about the dangers of talking to the FBI.
Yeah.
That honesty is not necessarily the best policy, that if the FBI shows up at your door or at your business, that we feel like we want to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
If I have nothing to hide, then why can't I talk to them? And he said, this article argues that following your first instincts could land you in federal prison. Ask Martha Stewart.
Okay, but...
Yeah, but she spoke to the FBI before she had an attorney present.
Yeah, but she was also, she did have something to hide.
Right. Right. But she should have had an attorney before she spoke to them.
That's fine. It's not really a great example, man, because I'm like, let's talk about somebody who was falsely accused.
Well, there.
Because, yeah, you know, fair. I feel like in that case, like, it's really a case for the FBI there. They were right.
Yeah, but everybody knows Martha Stewart's name. And okay, it was really kind of accidental. If you read all about her stuff,
there is
it's the insider trading thing that can be really
gray area.
And so anyway, she should have had an attorney present before she spoke to the FBI the first time.
All right. Okay. Well, I agree. And you know, in Cassie's case, I was thinking, you know, all right, she's not in sound mind when all this happens, because you don't wake up to somebody who has, like, been violently murdered next to you and then think clearly, right?
But yeah.
When she called her best friend the lawyer, maybe she should have told her what was going on, right? And maybe at least gotten some actual advice instead of just being random and sounding. But she had made so many poor choices as an alcoholic,
right.
really, that... She doesn't have a lot of margin with her friends.
Mm-hmm.
So when she does something that sounds like a drunk call, they just let it go.
Right.
But if she was thinking clearly, I feel like her next stop is the American Embassy.
Right.
That's it. Right. Like, get to the American Embassy and then talk to them.
Yeah, she's afraid she's going to lose her job.
Well, and I mean, she might have.
Yeah.
And I get that, too.
Yeah.
I get that, too.
Yeah, and he just goes on to very clearly state, my advice is, even when you are totally convinced that you didn't do anything wrong and that you are completely innocent of wrongdoing and therefore have nothing to hide, it is still unsafe to talk to federal agents without an attorney present.
It's fair.
I mean, really, because you have to knowingly lie. Mm-hmm. You have to know that it's a lie. Bestlifeonline.com has an article about things that flight attendants are never allowed to do. Mm-hmm. So, obviously they can't keep serving you if you've overindulged, like right. a bartender. They can't drink with you. We've already talked about that. But here's a couple of things that I didn't realize. So they accumulate flights. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a perk of working for an airline is you get to fly places.
Right.
But you can only use those flights for personal travel. Okay. So if you have a part-time job or some or an additional job and there was a conference, you couldn't use your flight that you've earned to go to that conference. You can only use it for personal travel, not business travel.
Oh, interesting.
And they cannot promote their outside interests. So if they're trying to sell you essential oils, they're breaking the rules.
No pyramid schemes on the airplane.
No pyramid schemes, but they can't ask you to subscribe to their podcast either.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so yes. That's fine. I'm never going to be a flight attendant, so it's fine. I can ask you to rate, review, and subscribe anywhere you get your podcast.
That's right. We can.
And then I didn't realize how many health risks there were to being a flight attendant. So even beyond like the normal ones that you would expect. So the Harvard Flight Attendant Health Study looked a few different things. So in addition to, you know, back issues or, you know, injuries you might have from falling or lifting heavy things or whatever like that, there's cosmic ionizing radiation.
Ooh.
Because you're flying up higher in the atmosphere, so you have less atmosphere to protect you from the radiation that comes from outer space. Mm-hmm. Normally we're pretty protected from that down here on the ground, but they spend more time with less atmosphere. So they're prone to higher levels of that, which might lead to different types of cancer, higher levels of cancer, higher rates of uterine, cervical, breast, gastrointestinal, thyroid, and melanoma cancers are much higher among flight attendants, like many times the risk, like quite a lot. There's a threefold increase in the age-adjusted prevalence of chronic bronchitis among flight attendants.
Oh, I was going to ask about lung disorders.
Even though they are much less likely to be smokers.
I was going to ask about that because cabin pressure is different.
Cabin pressure.
In fact, a lot of people think the jet lag is because it just sucks to be on an airplane for that long, but it's actually the reduced oxygen.
Yeah, it's reduced oxygen. They have the most physical job on the flight of anybody at a lower level of oxygen, so that they tend to have more lung issues and things like that.
That makes sense. In fact, that's something that the 787 sought to fix. Their cabins are more highly pressurized, and so you don't have such a lack of pressure, which means you don't have the lack of oxygen. Like, they're increasing the oxygen in the cabin and the pressurization to reduce like jet lag.
Okay.
So that you can not feel it as much, which would be great for the flight attendants on those.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's pretty cool. So next time we're going to watch a movie called A Kind of Murder.
On Hulu.
It's on Hulu. I think it was just like a regular movie. It's not a premium movie. You don't have to have HBO or anything to watch it.
Nice.
Somebody having a salacious affair and his wife turns up dead. You know, our thought is usually the husband did it. But
we'll see.
We will see.
We'll see. Is it a kind of a trope or is there a twist?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
It is.
In the trailer, he said something very interesting. He asks his friend, Is there a difference between wishing someone was dead and actually doing it? And this, the friend's like, yes.
Like, duh.
So we'll see.
All right. Until next time, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands.